You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. Learn more at diageobaracademy.com. That's Diageo Baracademy.com.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil wants his groove in them rhythm and blues that send. It's gonna get you some in the end.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm Damon Bolte.
I'm Souther Teague.
And I'm Greg Benson.
Gentlemen, we're all on the West Coast.
I know.
How did that even happen?
but not in the same place, of course.
Together.
We're still remote from one another. But we're peppering the West Coast. I'm in Vancouver. Greg, you're down in Seattle. And, of course, Damon, you're up in the Marin area. So
yeah.
It's the first time we've all been on the same timeline for the show in a long time.
Yeah. Welcome to my hell.
9 a.m. is rough.
Greg's at his weekly wedding.
It's true.
What are you doing in Vancouver?
Well, you might first jump to the conclusion that I'm, scouting for opening another place, but I'm not.
Right.
at least not officially. I am looking around though. No, I'm here visiting with Natalie's parents, and we've had a great time. We've been out muscling in the very frigid waters, right off the coast of Cannon Beach, right next to Haystack Rock. I think Damon, you were saying. The Goonies was filmed near there.
Yeah, the Goonies was filmed there in that town of Astoria. And, of course, like Cannon Beach and Haystack Rock. And, it's kind of funny you mentioned scouting for bars because it's still on the table. My friend Lucas and I have been talking for a few years about opening a bar there in Astoria, Oregon.
Wait,
that
Lucas
bridge
from,
freaks me out.
Lucas from the barware company, right?
Yeah, from Bull in China. And,
Bull in China, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we're still talking about it. We talk about a lot of stuff, though.
I mean, it's a quaint little town, and it's gorgeous, and, the weather has held up really well for us. It normally is kind of pissy rain, but I think I'm one of the few people per year that gets a sunburn. I got a sunburn out here, and we were out on the beach all day long, from literally sun up until dusk, it was beautiful, and that's why we weren't going in.
I don't really see Souther Teague as a beach person,
I grew up on a beach.
I can see it, but I can see him in one of those sort of like striped coverall things from like the 1800s,
Yeah, like when I grew up on the beach. But we've been having a great time. Greg, why are you out on the West Coast?
Because another one of my friends is getting married. This is actually for a bachelor party, and I'm with you. I'm also sunburned in Seattle, which I feel like I'm just walking around, and I feel like people are looking at me, and the fact that my face has been nice and pink for the last couple of days, and they're like, "You're not from around here, are you, buddy?" Like,
yeah.
Saturday it was a beautiful day, so we went for a float out on the Puget Sound. We rented this little boat that was shaped like a donut, powered by an outboard motor that I'm pretty sure had like the propulsive capability of, a standard hair dryer, going a stunning, like half a mile an hour the entire time. But it was, hanging out, seeing some sights on the water, getting some sun, drinking some beers, and, visiting some cool bars up here, man. I was out at Navy Strength last night and popped over to Rob Roy, both of which were delightful. And then great spots. Couldn't give them more rave reviews. And then when my alarm went off at 8:15 this morning, my first thought was, Jesus Christ, how does Damon do this every week? It's just like, this is inhumane. So my hat is off to you more than usual, buddy. The West Coast is not for the faint of heart.
Well, yeah. He's also not bachelor partying every night that he
yeah, exactly.
that exists.
This is true. Well, so the bachelor party was part one. This is actually, I'm out here doing a little bit of research for another project that I'm not super at liberty to talk about right now. I'm not opening a bar. Don't worry. I'm not stepping on your branding, Souther, but I was doing a little bit of Pacific Northwest research and getting a little business tipsy last night. So, you know, you work hard, you play hard.
Listen, that's all we all know. And I think nobody knows that better than our guests in the studio, in the virtual studio with us today, mm-hmm. Working hard and playing hard. We got Kate Gerwin in with us from Happy Accidents Bar. Kate, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here virtually.
Yeah. we're so glad to have you on. First time you've been on the show, which shocks me. Actually, I asked you off the air. I thought maybe you'd been on in the past before I was on even, but it turns out you haven't. So
no.
way overdue to have you on. You're such a character in our in our sphere, and we want to hear about what you've got going down there at Happy Accidents. So tell us a little bit about the bar. Is it even 1 year old yet?
We hit 1 year a couple weeks ago, May 1st. Okay. So we are officially a year. Very proud, very happy to make that milestone. And kind of when I first opened, I kept our concept a little under wraps. I wanted to make sure that everything panned out the way my brain told me it would. and I'm quite grateful that it did.
Yeah, you were pretty prolific in posting about documenting the build out, which was pretty fascinating to me. And I'd like to start there, because when we get past build out and get to how you operate, that's where it really starts to get interesting.
But yeah,
but I know that on your Instagram handle at Happy Accidents Bar, you have in your archives all of the steps you guys went through to really DIY that space. You want to talk about that a little bit?
It was definitely as DIY as it gets for a bar. So my business partner, Blaze, and I have consulted on many projects and built bars for other people, never for ourselves. And we kind of took all of our learned experiences, and also a lot of it had to do with budgeting. You know, we opened the bar during the pandemic. We have one silent investor who's been very gracious to us and kind of just, you know, wrote us a check and said, pay us when you can, you know, just literally like pandemic, whatever, we'll figure it out. And they were really, really kind. And the rest, to be honest, is like maxing out my credit cards. Like we 100% did it ourselves. So everything that we could do, we did ourselves. And that ended up being everything. We built the tables, we did the floors, we refinished everything, we did the bar top, we ripped out all the draft lines and redid those. Luckily, my business partner is a former engineer major and quite a genius master of trades, so I'm very lucky there. But we quite literally did everything. My grandma was a art teacher. She was really into art, she loved Bob Ross, hence the name Happy Accidents. So I grew up, not only watching Bob Ross, but doing some painting myself. We found things on Craigslist, mannequins, bodies, things, kind of tacked them into the walls, painted them, mudded them, sanded things. We have it's a large indoor space, so we needed to soundproof, and the quote I got from soundproofing was like $7,000, which was way out of our budget. So, I did some research and found a K-pop recording studio that had used AstroTurf as their soundproofing. And I ended up going to, yeah, it was actually, it looks pretty cool too, but I went to a landscaper that does the golf courses around here and ended up getting their scraps, two truckloads. It was over like 4 months period, collecting them for about $250 a truckload. And we covered the ceiling with AstroTurf, which actually ended up being one of the best soundproofings I've ever used in a bar and looks pretty cool. And people That's are always awesome. Taking pictures of it. Yeah. So, I mean, it was to say it was a labor of love is, an understatement. I think it's the only time it stressed mine and Blaze's partnership to the max, you know, like trying to figure things out and doing things ourselves. And what usually happens is I get these harebrained ideas, like the AstroTurf or like these mannequins on the wall. And I go, okay, this is what I want to do. And then Blaze goes, okay, how am I going to figure out how to do this? And then I keep telling him, I know you can do it. You'll figure it out. You'll just figure it out. And he's like, you're kidding me, right? But we did figure most everything out. Our tables are made from breeze block. We do a lot of epoxy. So everything that we did, that looks like marble or crazy colors, we have a epoxy pink neon pink and purple floor. We have a wall full of graffiti that I'm a huge graffiti fan, and I have one of my favorite graffiti artists out of New York City is Adam Fu, and he does a lot of really cool neon graffiti work. And I couldn't get him to come out. It was the pandemic. So he sent me little tutorials, and I did my first graffiti piece on the wall, which pat myself on the back turned out pretty well.
Yeah,
thank you. So, all in all, things fell into place, and we were able to open the bar. I wouldn't say under budget, but under maxing out my credit cards just enough to get the bar out. We'll say it that way. And yeah, we opened in May.
Yeah, I think it's also pretty incredible that you had the, strength of will, or just honestly, maybe even just strength after all of that DIY to record it, to, put it up and hold on to it. And it's really great to go back and watch over. I was watching it as it was happening.
But yeah.
Then to see the place operational and to go back and kind of watch it again, it's like, wow, these guys really went all in.
Yeah. Had I had the hindsight, whatever, but had I realized, I probably would have done a better job recording it, because most of it was just like Instagram stories and sharing it with my friends because I knew they thought it was cool. But now when people go back, now that we've been open a year, when people go back and look at it, they're like, holy cow. Like, you guys literally built this bar with your bare hands. I'm like, yeah, we literally did. I mean, I did all of the upholstery. We built the booths. We built the tables. Like, there isn't anything in there that we didn't do. Blaze knows how to weld, so we welded things. We contracted. The only contractor we ever ended up paying and hiring was a guy to redo our walk-in, because the walk-in wasn't getting to temp. And that is definitely not my area of expertise. We had to put in new electrical. We have a huge, huge walk-in because, as you'll learn later, we have a massive draft cocktail program. So that was it. That was the only person we had to pay outside of ourselves. So the build-out ended up costing, it was under $150,000 all said and done. And that included all new equipment, all new kitchen equipment, everything that we did. Now, obviously, we didn't pay ourselves for the work, and we did a lot of the work ourselves. So we were really lucky in that. I don't know that a lot of people could have done what we did. But yeah, we were real lucky.
I've often wondered, like, how much time and effort it would take for me to, like, sidebar and go to a tech school and become an HVAC technician just to help out my bar and my friends' bars. You know what I mean? Because, like, seriously,
I fully support this, by the way.
Yeah. Because, like, I mean, just ice machines alone, like cold drafts are always going down, and like everyone's like freaking out. Like, if I could just be that guy to help out, just to help out bars in need, I feel like that would be a worthy endeavor, right? But also, like, to kind of expand on the DIY thing, like, I'm a huge, like, fan of the state of New Mexico. I go there. I've been all over. I go there all the time. I think I said before the show, my twin brother got married in Santa Fe, and just that spirit of, like, there's like a lot of kind of like DIY artistry going on in New Mexico. Like, for instance, Meow Wolf
in
Santa Fe.
Yeah, Meow Wolf. People compare our bar to Meow Wolf a lot, which is awesome. And also, I had never been to Meow Wolf before we built out the bar. So once I went there, I was like, oh, okay. I got this.
Very cool. Yeah. I mean, like, that's like when you were talking about that, I was like, oh yeah, that kind of reminds me of like found objects. And like, I love the AstroTurf thing. I'm going to do that in my band studio now. We've been trying to figure
honestly,
out.
Honestly, like, it is so effective. Like, even when we went into the space, we threw all the AstroTurf on the ground just to like lay it out. The room just got quieter immediately. And we were like, oh, this is going to work better than we even thought. And those little panels, those god awful panels with the felt that they do for soundproofing, they're ugly and they take
a lot of expensive.
They're expensive. And they take a lot of the height out of a room where, it's the whole point is having these great high ceilings, and then it's just an echo chamber. So I don't know that I would ever be able to not do AstroTurf again.
That's amazing.
Raise a glass to the K-pop situation.
Yep. Yeah, seriously.
Who knew you'd be influenced by K-pop?
And to your local golf course guy, too. That's I just want one more question about the AstroTurf, because you said that you got the scraps. Were they did they come in tiles, or did they just come in like weird shapes that you had to sort of
weird shapes for sure, and rolls. So sometimes we'd get huge rolls. Sometimes we'd get, and the other thing is because we didn't, you know, and we were just getting what he had, there'd be different grades. You learn a lot about things when you build. And one of the things I learned is there's lots of different types of AstroTurf. There's different grades. There's different qualities. There's different thicknesses. Some of it would be like really thick and bushy. So the ceiling kind of looks, what it reminds me of is it looks like when you're flying over like the Midwestern states and you see like the little patterns and squares. So there was definitely a learning curve. We thought we would get big, huge pieces and put them up, but the strength that it took just for us to hold up pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have to, you know, we have a 10-year plaster roof. So first we thought a staple gun would work, and that was like, no, it just fell right back down. So then it was, I mean, we went through like 7 different times of different, you know, nail guns and different nails and different widths. And at one point, you know, Blaze would look at me and be like, okay, this isn't going to happen. We're going to have to pivot. And I'm like, we're not pivoting. Like, I'm not doing it. It's going to happen. I'm going to make fetch happen. Like, it's going to happen. And eventually we figured it out. And now we have a system for it. And then my chef, who is a former bartender from Silver Lion in New Orleans, she moved out back. She was from New Mexico, moved away, came back. She ended up really kind of enjoying the Tetris aspect of it. And she ended up finishing it off for us because we would work on the ceiling for a couple of days and we'd get completely over it. And we'd just stop and go on to another project until our minds could handle. And then we would go back and do a little bit more. When she moved out here, she was like, oh, I love this. And I was like, great, finish it. Yeah. Please.
It's also exhausting, like with your arms up, like in your neck cocked back, like looking up at the ceiling and holding things up. It's like, I've done some stuff like that before. And it's like, short blast.
Yeah. Scaffolding is not, I don't like heights. So it wasn't my favorite job. I'm like, I'm good. Thank you. You guys do this.
Yeah. Amazing.
But we also put like tons of quirky I love quirkiness. I love random things. So one of the things I'm looking to do now is I want to actually make it look like you're flying over and put like a couple little cows and like little farmhouses out there. I in one of the areas I have like an ivy river going through it, and so I plan on building onto it and making it look even more funky than it already does.
So like an upside down diorama.
Yes.
May I suggest a tiny scale replica of the city of Des Moines, Iowa? I think that would really go over nicely.
Just
perfect.
Just for me, my flyover city of choice to harp on Des Moines. So talk a little bit about, before we take a break, talk a little bit about the concept of the bar in general. Like, I, of course, love the aesthetic and love all the DIY stuff you guys did. And again, I would encourage our listeners to go check out your Instagram and look through the archives and see all this really cool stuff you guys did. But I guess the undertone here to this question is why? What was the driver?
The short word is the pandemic. The long word is, you know, equity and profitability for independent bars. You know, I have done consulting the last 12 years. And as you know, Souther, bars just don't make money. Everybody thinks that bartenders or bar owners are like floating in this pool of green. And honestly, for my experiences, unless you, you're flying under the corporate radar, it's just not how it works. So we consulted in Santa Cruz for a couple projects there, and that's where we were located. And when that project ended, we wanted to do something for ourselves. And I love small market work. So my daughter lives here in New Mexico. And honestly, the pandemic had just started and we couldn't afford to live in California. And it was like, all right, let's go to New Mexico. So we got here to New Mexico, and I wanted to open our own bar. But the problem here in New Mexico is that liquor licenses are highly allocated, and they cost about $350,000 to $400,000. They're treated like property. They're either handed down through generations. So if there's an independent bar that's had one, they've had it for a long time, or the corporations come and snatch it up because there's not many people who can start out with a $400,000 debt just for a piece of paper.
Yeah, I would like to, can I just interject and put that into perspective for the listener? You know, I'm in New York City where most of my operations are, and a license is, you know, it renews every year, but it's only $5,000.
Yeah.
And they're not in short supply.
They're not. And it's most places, the highest that you come across, except for places like New Mexico or Texas, they're really $10,000, $20,000. We're talking $400,000 for a liquor license here. And that's why the cocktail scene here is not as prominent as it should be. That's why there's not a lot of independent places, is because it's mostly your, you know, Applebee's and your Olive Gardens that can afford that kind of investment. We just can't do it. So I was talking to my liquor license broker, and, you know, her and I were talking about whether this was even viable. Because now that I've been doing the books and doing all of these consultings, I just couldn't really see that it was a smart move to start out with that kind of debt. Then I was going to have to go find investors. And then, you know, you're really handing off all of your money to other people. So I kind of just was sitting around talking to her about licensing. And she said, well, do you know how to distill? And I was like, well, what do you mean? And she's like, well, the craft distiller's licenses here in New Mexico are $750. And I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Did you forget a few zeros in a comma?
Yeah, I'm like, wait, I'm sorry, huh? And she's like, yeah, you know, distiller's licenses here are $750, and they all come with actually three tasting rooms.
What?
Yeah. Yeah.
So $250 a bar.
Basically. Yeah, pretty much. Wow. And she's like, you know, you can distill. And I'm sitting there going, well, I mean, distillation isn't difficult, right? Like now let me say that, like, there's one thing of home distillation or doing moonshine. Like it's a pretty easy science. But on the other hand, I'm not trying to say that we're master distillers, right? Like I'm not going to open up and be like, yeah, I make this amazing 3-month-old whiskey that is just stellar. Cause we all know how that goes. Like you need to, you got to know the science. You got to know, there's a reason why master distillers are called master distillers. So I'm kind of like I'm sitting around playing with this idea of like, am I seriously going to start distilling? Like, I took bar five and I know the science of stuff. And I grew up in Napa and I wanted to be a winemaker, and I've worked at wineries. You know, I used to shovel grapes and I was a cellar rat. And I'm like, I mean, I know all this stuff. It's not that I don't know it. And then I'm thinking, and honestly, so here's where we go with this process. I'm thinking, well, you know, High West, their whole thing was that they purchase and they blend, and we all know MGP, right? Like everyone knows MGP, and mm-hmm. let's real talk. We all know that there's the, you know, like there's vodka companies, Tito's, that, you know, purchase in bulk. excuse me, I had something in my throat. And who have been sued for saying that they distill everything, when we all know, so everyone in the industry knows that distilleries buy from distilleries, right? Like we all know it. It just happens. The craft distilleries that start out as whiskey distilleries, you don't open and then just have a 5-year whiskey, right? Like I know consumers don't put those two things together, but we all know that most of these craft small whiskey distilleries are probably purchasing from MGP, and they're blending and they're redistilling or they're doing other things to it, but they're not actually coming out the gate with a 4 or 5 year whiskey. So,
right, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. I want to
not at all. So, yeah, I mean, like MGP, MGP makes some of the best whiskeys in the world. So I'm kind of like, okay, I need to do some more research. And I start reaching out to bulk producers and I start doing some research on the laws. And I'll be real honest, the TTB they're real helpful. They want to make money off alcohol taxes. So I called the TTB and I was like, okay, what can I do? And they're like, oh, you know, all distilleries can purchase from other distilleries. It's transfer and bond. And you get it back, and what you do with it, you know, you can, you know, redistill it, you can make one-offs, you can do whatever, you can blend it, and that's a distiller's license. And so I was very lucky in my career that I got to spend a lot of time in Amsterdam. And I worked with a Geneva company, and I got to go out there all the time. And, you know, in Amsterdam, there are a lot of distillery bars. And if you really if you know your history, a lot of bars back in the day started as blending houses. You know, that's how kind of like Ray and Nephew and some of these rum, that's just how it was, is back in the day when there wasn't a 3-tier and there wasn't all these stuff. Bars got barrels from distilleries And they made blends and they made houses blends. And if you go to Amsterdam, there's still distillery bars back from, you know, there were like hundreds and hundreds of years ago. So I started thinking about it and I'm like, well, if I have this craft distiller's license and I buy a still, and we have a still and we do distillations, I can have the control that I want to for all of my spirits. I can purchase from any distillery in the world. I also have an importer's license, so I can import from any distiller, or, I mean, like, we import 5 different agaves from Mexico. I import Sotol, Bacanora, Ricia. But I can do all of these things, and I get it in bulk, and I bring it to my distillery, and I can make it taste the exact same way I want to for each cocktail. So I call the TTB, I go through the whole program with them, you know, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I want. And they're like, yeah, it's a go for it. And that's kind of where it started. It was, you know, my $750 craft distiller's license turned into what I call our distillery bar. So we are a craft distillery. Our quote unquote bar is a tasting room where, you know, you can come in and taste through our products, and you can taste through them in straight form, or you can taste through them in cocktail form. We have 100 draft lines. They mirror each other, so 50 and 50. We have 72 cocktails on the menu right now, 36-ish of which are drafts. So for example, if I, you know, I purchase vodka or gin in bulk, my gin comes in at like 192 proof. For different cocktails, we redistill. So like I have a citrus gin. We take our gin base. We add all of the things that we want to do to it. We redistill it. We, from that point, can proof it and go right into our kegs. We can go into our bottles. We don't have a back bar. We don't have a huge thing. Our back bar is just 100 draft lines. But we go right into our bottles and our kegs, and each cocktail has the gin or the spirit in it that we have specifically designed for that cocktail. So if we want a higher proof, we, you know, proof it down to a different proof. If we want, I also have, so in the back, I have barrels and barrels of whiskey. I have, you know, 100% rye barrel. I have 100% corn barrel. I have 100% wheated. I also have a bourbon blend. And for each drink that we want, say we want 5% more rye, we add 5% more rye. If we want it, you know, a lower proof, we make it a lower proof. And basically the bartenders get to go back and distill whatever the heck they want. If they're like, hey, I want a lavender gin, they're like, cool, go in the back, grab some gin, throw it in the still with some lavender, and poof, we have a lavender gin.
I mean, I have so many questions here, just even on how, like, first of all, the savings of money. You saved like $399,000. And then, of course, yes, the education level that your team is getting from getting to do this stuff, the experience that they're getting to have with this stuff, it's incredible. But we do have to take a quick break and hear from our sponsors. We're going to come back and keep talking about this fascinating bar, Happy Accidents, with Kate Gerwin. We'll be right back. Hey, Greg, I hear you're going to Nashville. When's that?
You bet I am, man. It's next week. I'm going down there for World Class, brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. I'm going to be going to the U.S. Finals, talking to some people, drinking some drinks. You know, it's a hard life that I lead, Souther, but someone's got to do it.
Man, I love that for you, and it's going to be great. You know, DiageoBarAcademy.com focuses on representing the global bar community with diverse content created by experts and enthusiasts from around the world, championing the passions of bartenders, upskilling those new to the industry, and supporting owners and operators to solve problems they face in their bars and restaurants. You should join the community of Diageo Bar Academy today.
Absolutely, man. And, you know, if you've been listening to this show for a little while, you've heard us banter about Diageo Bar Academy on this podcast. But, you know, we keep doing it because it's totally free. Like, I just can't get over that. The fact that it's a totally free resource for bartenders, bar managers, and really anybody who's in the hospitality industry.
Yeah, or even hospitality adjacent. You know, enthusiasts can join along too. Education is great for everyone. You know, so whether you're an experienced bartender looking for a new inspiration and trends, or you're just starting out, I think Diageo Bar Academy is the place for you.
Absolutely, man. And you can find everything that they do, all the great courses, all the e-learning courses, all the master classes. You can find those at DiageoBarAcademy.com. Go there to build your skills, train for it, whether you're a newbie or a bar professional, and you can even become a member for instant access to their global bar program. So don't wait. Go to DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's DiageoBarAcademy.com today and check it out.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network for 10 years. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's, the pizza restaurant, is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. And of course, there's the 2-Michelin-starred Blanca tucked away in the garden for truly daring diners. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City and now in Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
And we are back. You're listening to the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. And goddamn, I'm really missing New Mexico right now. We've got Kate Gerwin in the studio today, and we've been talking about her awesome distillery bar, Happy Accidents, in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And wow, this is I'm seriously like, I've been talking about moving into Mexico and opening a bar for a while, and now I know how. This is a crazy amount of information that, like, this is very important. Like, you've done a lot of work to, you've cracked the code here, it seems like. So let's continue talking about this. Let's pick up where we left off, right? You have 100 taps, 100 draft lines. You've got a distillery in the back. If you want to make lavender gin, you just go make lavender gin. This is incredible. So one question that I have for you is that, to have this distillery bar license, is there a certain quota of product that you have to sell?
Not sell. You actually don't have to sell anything. Produce, yes. Okay. So the idea of you having to sell something would be like, if we're making whiskey and aging it, we would have to sell it. And that's actually not how the TTB runs. They don't really care about how much you sell. They care about how much you produce. So we have to produce 500 gallons a year, which is actually, in the grand scheme of things, not that much.
Right. I had that much to drink this morning.
Same.
Yeah. So we already did our first renewal, and we were able, I mean, we produced way more than 500 gallons. We were wondering how close we would get to that, but we far succeeded that, and that wasn't a problem. And we were relicensed, and they came and they inspect your facility, and they look at everything, and they're like, oh, okay, cool. You guys are distilling this, and this is what you're doing, and there's all your barrels, and cool, thanks, bye.
I mean, I have so many questions, and I'm going to start with this one. So, well, it's a two-parter. You have to make everything that you sell. Is that correct?
Yes. I mean, so we
If you want to make a Negroni, you've kind of got to make your own Campari, right?
Yeah. So that is definitely the hard part is that we can, so I have a beer and wine license. I can purchase fortifieds and fermented. But I cannot purchase anything distilled unless it comes directly from a distillery. So I can't go through and buy Campari unless Campari wants to start selling to me. Now, should Campari, and this is my hope, is that more of our independent sector starts doing this, because more people are actually being willing to work with us. Beam Centauri, I just talked to them, and they're like, yeah, we want to start selling you guys barrels. So anyone can, in fact, sell direct to us. It's whether they want to or they're willing to.
Right. If it's worth their time and effort.
If it's worth their time and effort and energy. So anyone that's producing Amaros or producing, you know, herbal liqueurs or things like that, give me a call, because yeah, I'm sure all about that life. Because I love that idea that the larger, the more people that are doing this, the more distilleries are going to, and if, you know, with the supply chain issues and glassware shortages and all of the things and the cost in bottling and the cost for distilleries, you know, Philip Duff used to do a seminar where he would break down how much it costs to make a bottle, how much it costs to bottle it, how much it costs to go through the three-tier system, and how much it costs for bar owners to buy it. And then he would break down the percentages of, like, you know, distilleries make like 30 cents and then, you know, bar owners make like, you know, a couple bucks, and then here's where all the money goes. And I, you know, it's not that we're, you know, the three-tier system is always going to be here. Like, I get it. I understand, you know, I don't love it, but you know, there's Costco's and Applebee's and grocery stores, and they don't have they're not going to become distillers. This for me is a way for the, you know, 2 to 7% of the independent cocktail bars to not only have the control over their spirits, but to work directly with the brands that we love so much and be able to work with them and put more money in their pockets. Importing our agave spirits, are the farmers and the pequeñas and distilleries that we work through in Mexico make more money off of selling to me than they ever would off of bottling and selling to the big boys. So it's enabling people to put the money back into the pockets of the people who really hit hard in the pandemic, mm-hmm. and not able to sustain their businesses or pay their staff or have equitable places to work because we're all struggling to cramble, you know, to get every penny out of this 2 to 12% profit that bars have been stuck, you know, and then of course now even smaller. Rents are climbing, rents are atrocious. I mean, our insurance is atrocious as it is, let alone all of the money that's put in all these different places.
Yeah, it's astounding. And it seems like you've found a good niche way in your state anyway to kind of cut past some of that and put more dollars in your pocket as well as your team. And I want to come back and talk about that as well. But my second part of my question was, you have to make everything, but you're a distiller's license and you have a tasting room. Can I come to your bar and buy a bottle?
Yes.
And I can walk off with it?
Yes.
So you're on premise and off premise?
Yes.
And do you do that?
We do. Yeah, I know.
I love that very delayed. What?
Yeah. We can also literally bottle right off our tap. Our drafts. So, you know, we make 5-6 different milk punches. We have, you know, gin and tonic on draft. You can just come in and I can bottle a gin and tonic bottle and you can walk out the door with it.
Of any size. I can get a half liter, I can get a liter, yep. Whatever. Amazing. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Bring your growler in. We'll fill it up off the tap.
Pretty much. Yeah.
And then again, kind of circling back to what you touched on and I touched on as well, with this sort of, I don't want to call it savings, but with this extra margin, you are able to do something that is kind of still unheard of in our field, and I'm striving to finally, you know, get in that direction with my own company. You can pay a higher wage, offer, yep. full health benefits and paid time off, which is completely unusual in our field, and I'm sure that's helped during the pandemic, because, you know, one of the things that I've certainly had troubles with, and I'm sure Damon has too, is retention and staffing.
Yeah, I mean, the whole point was to be able to open a bar and create a space where people were valued. And we would never be in the situation during the pandemic where we were worried about the livelihood of our staff. So how they were going to put food in their mouths. And everyone gets a living wage. Everyone gets, you know, we have health insurance. We try and make the business as equitable as possible. And after a year, we open positions up to profit sharing. And then we also offer partnership. And as we grow, as like, I'll get into in a minute, we're actually looking for another location. Our goal is that our bartenders become owners and they become partners in what we're doing. I was a consultant for many years and I always promised the world, you know, help us open this bar and one day you'll be a partner. And like, you know, I opened a bar in North Dakota and I was there for 4 years. And every year it was, well, next year we'll make you partner. Well, next year we'll make you partner. We just want to do this and next year we'll make you partner. And then it never really happens, or you're never really, I made a lot of people a lot of money. And at the end I was just their bartender. I was just the person that was, you know, making some drinks for them. And I don't ever want my staff to feel that way. And I'm a bartender at heart. You know, like people are like, oh, you're a businesswoman, you're not a bartender. I call myself a bartender till the day I die, because that's who I am and that's what I am. And I want all of my bartenders to be able to, you know, I want them to work so that they can thrive, not just so that they can survive. So the goal is that as we grow, every bar we grow with, our bartenders become partners, and they have equity and they have value, and they realize that their work is important and that it will pay off. So the goal is that, you know, they're all part of the team, part of the plan. Our next phase is actually, so when I started this, I really thought I would just own bars. And I would, like, well, we'll get three more bars out of it and maybe we'll do this. And as I'm realizing that the distillery aspect of it is so exciting and the bartenders love it. And, you know, RTDs are just on fire right now. Mm-hmm. Our next location, we're looking for a warehouse so that we can buy a canning line and start doing RTDs. And our cocktails will basically get canned now. And the bartenders can basically, and since we'll have our own canning line, bartenders can come in and, you know, we have a drink that works well and they'll go bottle it, can it, and send it out the door. And not only will we have the opportunity for people to come into the tasting room and try all the cocktails that we can, you know, we can also not only just sell in our state, the hope and the goal is that maybe by 2024, we'll go national and be able to actually, you know, you'd be able to have just our line of drinks on our menu anywhere else you want to drink.
Amazing.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. You know, a lot of people out there, Kate, are making room at the table for people. A lot of people are building a longer table. It sounds to me like you're just building a whole new kitchen to service that table. I don't know how to even think about all this. It's incredible.
Well, you know, the people that work for us make us who we are. And I don't in any way, shape, or form believe that this is just me. You know, my business partner, Blaze, he started working for me when he was 19, and he was a server in my restaurant. And then, you know, he became a bartender where I worked, and then he became my bar manager. And after 12 years, he became my business partner. He's a little more quiet, a little shy, but I don't in any way believe that where I got where I was if it wasn't for the help of the people who have lifted me up and supported me. And if I don't give back to them, I just don't really feel like I deserve what I'm getting. So my investors are some of the coolest and most genuine people you'll ever meet. And when we did this concept and they gave us, you know, the money to open the bar, I kept asking them what they want in return. And they said, we just want to see you succeed and we want to see you pay it forward. So in my mind, if I'm not paying it forward, then I'm not doing a service to them and what they've given me. And honestly, as anyone I think who's ran a business knows, you're not who you are without the people that work for you. And if we don't start valuing the people who work for us, we're just not gonna make it.
Absolutely right. This is awesome. Also, I mean, first of all, one thing, I can't believe that a guy with the name Blaze Montana is Quiet Guy.
He is.
But second, I would open a bar with you.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm always down. Yeah. So we had a lawyer do some research. There are many states that you can do this concept in. The main thing is what your tasting room of a distillery bar allows you to do. And if you actually look, you know, like Ryan maybe at Rieger, they have a bar in their distillery. Now their focus is distilling and not that bar, but there are lots of states in the United States where this concept is absolutely a fit plug and play. And it just takes doing a little bit of digging and asking the right questions. And honestly, like I said, the TTB was really helpful. They were 100% on board with making sure that we did this. We did it correctly. We, you know, followed all the laws because for them, you know, they're just getting more tax money. Like they're not upset mm-hmm. about another distillery opening up so that they can make some more money. Mm-hmm. And they just wanted to make sure that we were following the laws and following the guidelines. And at any time I had a question, I'd call up the TTB and they'd be like, this is what you can do. This is what you can't. Simple.
Yeah, that's pretty big. I think we sort of vilify the TTB sometimes in our field. And
right.
Yeah,
it sounds like they're pretty helpful when it comes to the big stuff. I think the next step, though, Kate, is, you know, great. You've got this information and now you're willing to share it. And how many people would step on board and do this? Because I think it takes a certain type of person who says to themselves, I'm willing to operate a bar at this level where I have to literally create things to, you know, create the spirits themselves to make drinks with. I think that's a certain type of personality and you have it.
And that's kind of where I say, like, we're not going to take down the three tier, right? Like, you know, like Applebee's isn't going to start distilling. Like, they're, you know, remember when we all thought it was cool and we all started making our own Campari and we all started to try and make our own, like every bartender that I know in, you know, the uber dorky cocktail bars, we've all tried to make our own things, you know, like it was a stage that we all went through. Now I can honestly say, you know, we make our own, not Campari, we make our own Italian bitter liqueur. It will never, mine will never shine close to Campari. Campari is an iconic spirit. I love it. Mine is good. They have their secrets, and that's the reason why they're the masters at what they do. So there's that. I mean, it's not that I'm thinking that now we have a fabulous Negroni on the menu. It's freaking delicious. I have people tell me all the time, you know, this is probably one of the best Negronis I've ever had. But I always will, you know, kind of take a sidestep and be like, yeah, well, Campari is Campari for a reason. Chartreuse is Chartreuse for a reason. But that doesn't mean that we can't do what we do. And it just makes us more unique that we're doing the things we do. We do make our own, well, not to, we make our own Aperol, right? Like happy accidents, but we make a lot of kind of fun one-off things. And the cool thing for the bartenders is when they have a cocktail idea or they have an idea that they want to put a drink on the menu, because we encourage all of our bartenders to have space on the menu. You know, they'll come to me and they'll say, okay, I was thinking about this, this, and this. I'm like, cool, how are you going to make it? And then they get to go research. And for most bartenders, especially the younger bartenders that are kind of like, you know, trying to make a place for themselves, they actually really enjoy the idea that they get to create their own spirits to go in their own cocktails. I mean, this is 100% control for them. Do they want a higher alcohol? Do they want a lower alcohol? They're looking for a crusher. Are they looking for something that's like, you know, easily accessible? Do they want something boozy and stirred? And by the time they're done, they've literally had their hand in everything from distillation all the way up.
It's incredible. And I think that would certainly encourage, you know, someone like me to come and work at that bar. And again, like I said, I'm sure it helps with retention to.
I mean, we have Patrick Braga, who moved out last year. He was, you know, bartender for 7 years at Paper Plane in San Jose. And he was honestly 100% watching my social media feed. And he reached out and he was like, hey, this is really cool. Like, yeah. I kind of want to move. I can't name names, but I have a bartender from the East Coast who, after Tales, will be packing up and coming out. And I'm pretty excited that people, as word is spreading, people are realizing what we're doing and they're like, I kind of want to be a part of this. Like, who'd have thunk Albuquerque, New Mexico was going to be the place that bartenders were moving to, but I'm here for it.
Yeah, you need to, I mean, I don't know if you are this year, you're doing a thing at Tales. Are you going to get up and talk about this?
I'm not, mm-hmm. not, I mean, I'm not, mostly just because, I didn't talk about it too much when we first opened. For one, I wanted to make sure it worked. I wanted to make sure that everything we were doing, you know, was following all the TTB laws. We were doing everything we needed to do. And I wanted to make sure that I wasn't stepping on toes so much that people were going to come in with big lawyers and say, okay, this isn't going to work for us. Right. I was worried about the big brands. The good thing is that, you know, for the most part, we have friends that work at all of these places and they all want, like, in the end, all these guys do want us to succeed. And if we're still going to be able to buy their product and we're still going to be able to work on this stuff and we're not shutting anyone out, everyone has been really supportive. At first, I couldn't get anyone to talk to me about it. And after being open for a year, I now have some big boys that are looking at me going, okay, I see what you're doing and we like this and we want to be a part of it, because all it's going to do is help support the industry that we give a shit about. And it's important for me that people don't think that we're like, we're here to shut anyone down. Right. You know, the small percentage of us that can pull this off isn't going to affect what people think it is. It's not, you know, we're not taking down anything. It's just enabling us to thrive in the area that we should be able to. And honestly, when you really, if you know your cocktail history, this is taking us back before Prohibition. This is how it was done back then.
Sure.
So it's nothing new. I didn't recreate the wheel. I just found an old one.
Yeah, you just surfaced one. You dug it up.
Yeah.
What's the response like from the public? Are you getting some?
It's amazing. So I very, very rarely have. Now, we do have people who come in and say, you know, can I get XY brand this and this? And we'll say, nope, you know, we're a distillery, but this is what we do, blah, blah, blah. And I've never had anyone go, oh, well, I don't want that. So like we have a whiskey cola on draft. We make our own cola syrup. And I tell people when they come in all the time, you know, oh, you like, you know, XYZ and Coke, try ours and I'll probably ruin you for any other Coke you ever had, you know, rum and Coke, whatever you've ever had. Because, the other cool thing is I've always done draft cocktail programs, but the waste on draft cocktail programs is hurtful when you literally take a case of booze and you throw it in and you just literally have just thrown these bottles away. In the time that we've been open in a year, the only bottles we ever throw away is our vermouth and our sherry bottles. So we have quite literally thrown away 10 cases of bottles in a year. We don't ever throw bottles away. Our waste is so low. Our landlords had told us when we moved in, you're going to need to get another dumpster. The last restaurant had a second dumpster and I'm like, we won't. And we don't, and we had never had to. We also compost, but we've never really had to worry about the bottle waste because everything goes right into our kegs. We go straight, pretty much straight from like barrel to keg. And then our whiskey cola on draft, you know, we don't have post mix. We don't have soda guns. The whiskey goes into the keg. So it's cold, it's charged. The whiskey has dissolved CO2 in it. Our whiskey cola is completely effervescent. It stays cold the whole time. It stays bubbly the whole time. Even I tell people all the time, our vodka soda is the best vodka soda you'll ever have because it, you know, it's not getting watered down. It's not sitting on crushed ice. It's not on ice. It's not room temperature vodka being poured over with a little bit of soda from the gun. It is literally cold as it comes out and hits that ice because it's coming out of draft. So our highballs are some of my favorite. I love our gin and tonic. I love our whiskey soda and they're easy. And I don't want to ruin it too much for everybody, but if you, the cost of goods sold on a whiskey soda for, a vodka soda for me, you know, my vodka can come in, I'll just say it can come in at under 5 cents an ounce.
Jesus Christ.
Fuck.
All right, my God.
All right, we're definitely opening a bar together.
Unreal, Kate. And the thing is, you're so excited and excitable. I can hear it in your voice. It's palpable. And, man, we're excited to keep talking to you about this, but we're out of time. I think, Jens, if you'll agree, we got to have Kate back on to continue this conversation. And soon,
for sure.
Right? We're going to invite you back soon.
Absolutely.
I'm going to come to New Mexico. Because
there's so much we didn't get to in this episode that I want to talk about.
Yeah. And this is how I know this is a great, I've done this interview, but like my jaw has been on the floor the entire time. And I can tell it's been great talking to you because one of the things that we said that we wanted to talk about is how much we hate Google reviews and taking shit on online reviews is my favorite thing in the world. And the fact that we didn't get to it and the fact that I don't care about that at all, because I've just been fascinated this entire time, tells me I'm like, wow, this has been awesome. Thank you so much for joining us.
I mean, guys, as the curtain of the pandemic is finally peeling back, I think this is a trip worthy interview. We should go to Happy Accidents and sit down with Kate and talk to her there.
Let's do it.
I'm already going. Like, I think in August. So
let's plan a trip.
I'll see you, Kate.
We're all on the West Coast anyway. Layover. Just saying.
Yeah.
Souther, you and me, just like accidentally be like, oops, geez, I got bumped. What a shame.
A happy accident.
There you go. Well,
Kate, people can follow along with your hijinks at Alchemist Kate. That's you personally. But then, of course, Happy Accidents Bar on Instagram. And again, I highly encourage people to go check out your archived stories about the DIY aspect of opening the shop up in the first place. Really a pleasure to have you on. And I look so very forward to seeing you this year in New Orleans. And thank you so much for your time sitting down with us on the show today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Right on.
So
cool. So cool. So much good. Not a lot of bad. I can't believe it's like I'm just thinking about like 10 cases of bottles being recycled for a whole year. That's insane.
Yeah.
And I don't even like that's my recycling at home is more than that. Like every week. I'm so not even joking, man. But
so much to unpack here.
So much cool stuff. Thanks again, Kate, for being on the show. And thanks for everyone for listening to the Speakeasy on Heritage Radio Network. Check out many of the other shows on the station. Go to the website, click on the beating heart to donate to us to keep us going. And until next week, cheers, everyone.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll load.
The Speakeasy is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food and drink radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.